All right. Well, without further ado, I'll read today's sutta. So this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, number 15.5. Yes, 15.5. Oh, sorry, 14.15. Sorry. And it's called, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as walking back and forth. Bhante Sujato translates it as walking together. And it's called the Chankama Sutta. And that means walking in meditation, walking meditation. So they're walking meditation together. So I'll be reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation today, and I'll read through the whole sutta. And if you have a question or a comment during my reading, you're welcome to either raise your hand if you want to speak, or you can just pop it straight in the chat. But I'd love to hear some of your voices, as my voice can get quite tired sometimes. So it's good to have a change. And I'll also encourage our two in the room here to ask questions or make comments if they do have any. So this is walking back and forth, Chankama Sutta. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha on Mount Vulture Peak. Now on that occasion, not far from the Blessed One, the Venerable Sariputta was walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus, the Venerable Maha Moggallana, the Venerable Maha Kassapa, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Punga Mantaniputta, the Venerable Upali, the Venerable Ananda, was walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus. So that, that's just shortened. And so each of those bhikkhus was walking with their own group of bhikkhus. And not far from the Blessed One, Devadatta too was walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus. And then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, do you see Sariputta walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus?" "Yes, Venerable Sir. All those bhikkhus are of great wisdom. Do you see Moggallana walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus?" "Yes, Venerable Sir. All those bhikkhus have great spiritual power. And do you see Kassapa walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus?" "Yes, Venerable Sir. All those bhikkhus are proponents of the ascetic practices. Do you see Anuruddha walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus?" "Yes, Venerable Sir. All those bhikkhus possess the divine eye. Do you see Punga Mantaniputta walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus?" "Yes, Venerable Sir. All those bhikkhus are speakers on the Dhamma. Do you see Upali walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus?" "Yes, Venerable Sir. All those bhikkhus are upholders of the discipline." That's the Vinaya. "Do you see Ananda walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus?" "Yes, Venerable Sir. All those bhikkhus are highly learned." "Do you see Devadatta walking back and forth with a number of bhikkhus?" "Yes, Venerable Sir. All those bhikkhus have evil wishes." "Bhikkhus, by way of elements, that beings come together and unite." Oh, sorry. "Bhikkhus, it is by way of elements that beings come together and unite. Those of an inferior disposition come together and unite with those of an inferior disposition. Those of a good disposition come together and unite with those of a good disposition. In the past they did so, in the future they will do so, and now at present they do so too." So that concludes this sutta. And I had a giggle when I first read it, because I read Devadatta, and it was just interesting to see all of those bhikkhus who are following him have evil wishes, or corrupt wishes is another translation. But it's kind of a funny punchline, I thought. Just mention some of my own kind of questions that I answered before this session. Does anybody have any questions or comments to start us off, including you two in the way there in the back there in the back of the room? Yes. Gosha, you have a question?
I have a question now.
Maybe if you can come closer.
Yes, it's very interesting. I'm just curious. Do we know Devadatta? What kind of character was he? Does he appear anywhere else in the suttas?
He sure does.
What can we tell about him?
Yeah, and that was one of my own questions. And I was like, who is this Devadatta? And why is he, you know, hanging out with the Buddha but having evil wishes? So there's a number of suttas. So I just did a search on Sutta Central, and I put Devadatta, and a number of suttas came up. So I'm just going to actually find them, because they're called, they mention a lot of, they mention the evil wishes, but there are certain ones. So in the Anguttara 4s, there are a few things that are mentioned about Devadatta. Possessions, honor, and popularity came to Devadatta for his own ruin and downfall. And then there's this lovely simile, two lovely similes. It's like a banana tree or bamboo or a reed, all of which bear fruit to their own ruin and downfall. It's like a mule which becomes pregnant to its own ruin and downfall. In the same way, possessions, honor, and popularity came to Devadatta for his own ruin and downfall. So he was like praised a lot. And that's one of the things, it's mentioned in another sutta, one of the eight qualities which the Buddha recommends to overcome. So Devadatta also was, he himself was overcome and overwhelmed by gain, loss, fame, disgrace, honor, dishonor, corrupt wishes, bad friendship. And because of those things, Devadatta is going to a place of loss, to hell, there to remain for an eon, irredeemable. So obviously the Buddha is recommending that we do not do as Devadatta did. And we try to overcome those things. So he was kind of the example of not a good monk. Or was he? I don't even know if he was a monk, actually. I didn't really see that, but he was surrounded by a number of bhikkhus in the sutta. Because he's not, if you notice when I was reading, he's not called Venerable Devadatta. So I don't know if that's just because he was not worthy of veneration, or if he was not actually a monk. So yeah, it's interesting. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Good. Yeah. And we have a hand raised up, and then I'll go to the chat. Oh, we have a question on, or a comment on Devadatta. One moment, Corinne. I'll just read this out. So Devadatta tried to kill the Buddha several times. I don't think I came across that. Or maybe there were just too many on Devadatta and I didn't read them all. But yeah, interesting. So I will ask Corinne to unmute.
Good evening. Yes, I was just going to say the same, actually, that he tried several times to harm, to kill, and to undermine the Buddha. And from what I read, I think he was a book bhikkhu. And I think at some point he got caught up in his own hindrances.
Mm-hmm.
And he then at some point there were new bhikkhus who were not sufficiently familiar with the Dhamma, and he managed to sort of persuade them along his way of thinking. And then mm-hmm. I think there's a whole story to it, and I think the way the Buddha very calmly and just remained calm and consistent in who he was. If you read that, that is just so powerful. When you have somebody digging away, I think holding on to who you are, your own truth.
Yeah, I think I remember reading something about that, how the Buddha remained steady. That's while it. He was That's receiving this abuse.
Steady.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Brian. Sorry for going on.
Thank you for that. There was another thing on what you said that I wanted to comment on, about how he kind of coerced people to follow his way of thinking. Or maybe he didn't intentionally coerce people, but he... like maybe he was charismatic enough and other people wanted to follow his views because they were kind of, I don't know, catchy or something. And so, yeah, well, when I read this also, it reminded me of that old phrase, birds of a feather stick together. So people of like minds go towards one each other, one another. There we go. And also the people that we associate with, we end up thinking like them. So this is why good friendship on the path is so important. And, we don't want to end up with people like Devadatta. We want to end up with people like Venerable Sariputta or maybe Venerable Ananda. So, all right, I will move on. And I'm not sure who went first, but I think Joseph was next one. And then I'll go to the chat. So, Joseph, you could unmute.
Thank you, Anagarika. I wanted to spend some time with Venerable Sariputta. My mind feels inclined to talk about wisdom in the mentions in the sutta. There's this beautiful quote from another sutta where someone asks the Buddha, what is a person of great wisdom? What is a person of great wisdom? And he says, good, good, sadhu, sadhu. Your approach and articulation are excellent. It's a good question. An astute person with great wisdom is one who has no intention to hurt themselves or to hurt others or to hurt both. When they think, they only think of the benefit for themselves, for others, for both, and for the whole world. That's how a person is astute with great wisdom. Now, the reason I wanted to bring up this quote is because that sounds a lot like compassion. That sounds a lot like anukampa. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it'd be really interesting to discuss, we often hear wisdom and compassion, but it sounds like the definition of wisdom is compassionate. Like someone who is wise that's like a definition of wisdom is to be compassionate. Because, for example, when I was listening to that list of the different types of people, I was trying to see, oh, where do I incline to? Like, mm-hmm. where would I feel like metta and all these Brahma Vihara qualities, they seem to be inclining towards wisdom in that regard, because I don't really associate with, like, I don't really, or not associate, but don't really, can't relate to, like, having spiritual powers or knowing much about the Vinaya. So I felt inclined to, maybe if we could talk about the compassion or the kindfulness of wisdom. Mm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That is very true. I think wisdom and compassion do go hand in hand. And you need some wisdom in order to be compassionate, and you need compassion in order to develop wisdom. My first meditation retreat, I was just saying actually this morning how I developed, you know, this experience of hearing the teacher discuss everything that I was experiencing throughout the day. And this was a Goenka 10-day course. And these recordings were made sometime in the 90s, long ago, before I ever came to the teachings. And he, by that point, was already had already died. And still, he was speaking to me. And that meant that he was speaking to everyone. And so this compassion came up. And I guess there's a sense of wisdom as well. The wisdom that a human mind is a human mind. We all have these qualities, these human qualities, to greater or lesser degrees. And we can all recognize which qualities are beneficial for our own well-being and strive to develop those. Maybe not strive as in the sense of, like, I must develop these good qualities, but, you know, intend, have that positive intention to develop the qualities that lead to more compassion. But yeah, we do need the wisdom, and we need the experiential wisdom in order to have that knowledge. that brings up an interesting point. So, I mean, we do have some questions in the chat already, but for those of you who may need some encouragement, which one of those bhikkhus or Devadatta perhaps was the one that you kind of inclined towards? So I leave that for you to kind of muse on while I read out the next question that was in the chat. So John says, it's amazing how relevant the Buddha's teachings are 2,500 years later. This is how I made friends growing up, and this is how I see my six-year-old make friends. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not going to get into politics now, but the way that we see social media has, what social media has done is it has created this sort of thing where we have a view, we can search online for things that validate our view, and we can find groups of people that also validate our view, and then we've got our group. We walk together, we walk back and forth with those people who are like-minded. And in that context, we're not seeing other opinions because we're stuck in this bubble, this echo chamber of our own minds, which, yeah, it's kind of frightening. But also, we see that happening with more wholesome activities. Like there was somebody who was here that said that her daughter and her boyfriend had separated, and they did it in the most amicable way. And I think she was saying that they searched online for, like, how to break up with someone, like something along those lines. And they found all these tips. And so that they separated in a really kind of smooth and really quite casual way, not any sort of fighting involved, because they were able to make new friends before they actually separated, like each have their own kind of new friends. So, I mean, that kind of stuff is out there as well. And we have Dhamma groups, of course. So if you're only watching Dhamma on YouTube, YouTube is only going to give you, the algorithm is going to feed you more Dhamma. So you just have to be kind of choosy which Dhamma is the ones that you're looking for. So I think I'll move on to the next one. Some more comments on Devadatta. So Minori was saying that Devadatta was Buddha's brother-in-law, and he was a monk. Thank you. And Madhu says, I've heard he was a cousin of the Buddha. So it seems like he was related. He was some relative of the Buddha. So Kim would like a brief reminder of the interests and qualities of different Buddhas. I think maybe quickly do that, and then we can move on to Johnny. So Venerable Sariputta, he was the foremost bhikkhu in wisdom. who's next? Moggallana has great spiritual powers. Kassapa is a proponent of ascetic practices, so he lived rough. So he would wear rough fabric. He would only eat alms food, not accept invitations to a fancy meal, and that sort of lifestyle. Anuruddha possesses the divine eye, so he can kind of see things that most normal humans cannot see. Punga Mantaniputta was a great speaker on the Dhamma, so a good teacher. Upali is an upholder of the Vinaya, of the discipline. Ananda is highly learned. And last but not least, Devadatta, with evil wishes or corrupt wishes. So Johnny, I can ask you to unmute.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for holding the space. Yep. So my question is, what if someone from, say, Devadatta's group had those qualities but wanted to choose a different way and were to join another group? Then what would that do to the group? Would that kind of reduce the quality of this kind of self-reinforcing, I don't know, confirmation effect? I guess I'm just interested in where the bridge for transformation is.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you're talking about so part of that may come down to conditioning. So we're all conditioned beings, and we're just this bundle of khandhas. We're this bundle of, you know, matter, body, feeling, perception, sankhara, so volitional action, volitional formations of the mind, and sense, the six senses, the vijnana, the consciousness. So all of those things are conditioned. So those people who were drawn to Devadatta and his teachings may have had some prior conditioning that led them to be interested in what he had to say. So they would have to hear, I mean, you're saying that this is a kind of hypothetical situation that I don't really have an answer to. And I'd also like to put it back to you because I'm curious about your thoughts about it. So yeah, if one of those bhikkhus were to kind of deviate from the one who has evil wishes, what would happen? I mean, I don't personally know Devadatta. I don't know what sort of way how he would reprimand people who no longer wanted to follow him. But sometimes in sort of like cultish situations, you'd have to be really strong to leave that group. And you'd have to be willing to face extreme abuse, scrutiny, and just a lot of kind of horrible things could potentially come up. So yeah, possibly one of those monks who might decide to leave his group would have had to be quite strong and willing to face up to what would come. Yeah, I'm curious about your thoughts on that as well. Are you still unmuted? Yeah.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for your reflection. So I guess I didn't have an answer, but I guess my interest is that for me, the Dharma seems to be a path of going from, say, stronger negative seeds to having more positive seeds. Mm-hmm. And I guess in order to put yourself, for someone to put themselves, let's say they've had a really hard life, they have a lot of these negative energy inside them, then in order to transform that, they need to put themselves in a place full of the positive energy, but then they're also bringing all of those things. And I guess maybe I'd offer the question, to what extent can we reflect on what really matters and then make a decision irrespective of what we may come with? We may say, actually, you know, I have a lot of, say, bad intentions or whatever was said, but I thought about it and I really value all these other positive things, and I'm going to go and seek that out and hope that they can also hold that negative space while I transform, because they can see I've made the choice, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really important, and especially really important for those who have past trauma and are recognizing that and actively trying to heal. So, yeah, noticing qualities in ourselves that, you know, maybe aren't quite in line with the Buddha's teachings. Like if we're expressing a lot of negativity, say we have a lot of anger within us and it's coming out, and maybe you know, other people are kind of are punching bags, so to speak, not literally, hopefully, and that's a quality that we do not want to continue developing. we would like to develop more of the positive qualities, then absolutely that is the wisdom factor that we were talking about earlier. So recognizing that this is a quality that is not for my benefit and is actually for my own harm and for the harm of others, and I want to change that, and I want to surround myself with people who are going to encourage these more positive qualities, these more beneficial qualities to come out. And yeah, that's absolutely necessary, I think, for us to come out of suffering. So we have to have enough wisdom to be able to see that there is a quality in ourselves that is an absolutely human quality. Like we all have our levels of greed, aversion, delusion. Yeah. So thank you for your question.
Thank you.
So we'll ask Elvira to unmute. Am I saying your name correctly, Elvira?
Elvira.
Elvira, thank you.
Yeah, listening to your discussion right now, in my life, I have noticed that I had a period of hardship, physical and mental, and I noticed in myself that I became an angry person. Mm-hmm. So, long story short, this made me, I don't know, sort of, I guess, feel more compassion to, so to say, bad people of the world. Because when you experience, because I started thinking about them as those who are probably suffering a lot within them. But yeah, but why I raised my hand was to say that this sutta reminded me of Kalyanamitta Sutta. The Buddha says, you know, Ananda says, is the associating with right people half of the spiritual path, you know? Yeah, everyone knows it probably. And no, the Buddha says that it's the whole of the spiritual path or something like that. And how much true is that? I was thinking also about my friends and not myself, I guess, as well, and their husband and wife relationships. Sometimes my friends behave in such a way or speak so such things, and I know it's their husband saying this. He would never, like, you know, after 10 years or something like that of marriage. And when you're married, and it got me thinking, when you marry someone so maybe different from you, like, how much friction is there? Because, you know, you can run away from friends, and it's not so easy when you're in a committed relationship. So yeah, just offering those reflections.
Thank you for that. Yeah, and oftentimes we can kind of pick up the mannerisms of people around us. So if it's in a partnership where you're living with somebody and you're constantly surrounded with that person, I've noticed anyway that you know, I start to speak like other people. And I've noticed that even being here, only for how long have I been here? About 2 months. And, you know, I've started to pick up on a few of Venerable Chanda's little cute things that she does. And even Chi, because she's been here for now most of the time that I've been here. So, yeah, I mean, and that's stresses again the importance of developing enough wisdom, just enough wisdom to be able to pluck ourselves out of a negative situation and plant ourselves into a more beneficial situation, because people can really influence our minds, our attitudes, our behaviors, the way we dress. For those who have kids, maybe in high school especially, yeah, so we want to be hanging out with the right kind of people. So I'll ask Corinne to unmute.
Thank you, Venerable. I called you Venerable last year when I was not very well informed. Forgive me. Okay. Something on what Johnny was saying, this transformation, where, you know, how that transformative power. And I think it's really the way people are with each other, or even the way we are with each other, this sort of non-judgmental, unconditional positive regard. You know, you can feel it when you go to the Vihara, or when you go to retreats. It's this an overwhelming feeling of safety.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually need to talk. I don't need to have a conversation. It's just the energy.
Yeah.
And when I went to a retreat in Oxford, I could feel it in my body. My nervous system was just, no. So it's these subtle energies, how we are with each other, how we hold each other without physically holding, but mentally, emotionally, that respect, that kindfulness.
Yeah.
And that opens, that allows for the transformation. That's the right conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually this came up in a discussion, our after lunch discussion today. We were talking about how important it is to be able to feel safe in our environment. And it's interesting that you mentioned also, like, when you come to the Vihara or when you're at a retreat or go to a monastery, you can feel this sense of safety. And that's exactly what a monastery tries to provide. And it's lovely that you can experience that. I've had the same sort of experience, just being at a retreat center or coming here, just being totally held, totally supported. And we want to, again, we want to notice that. We want to notice that this place, these people, are offering this sense of whether it's safety, whether it's support, but it's some sort of quality that is good and beneficial to ourselves. And it's good to reflect on that after leaving or while you're in that situation, because then we can kind of embed that good feeling in our minds. Dr. Rick Hansen, he has this practice he calls taking in the good. And he says that I think you need to hold a positive feeling or a positive memory in your mind for about, is it 30 seconds or a minute? But negative experiences, he says, stick to our minds like Velcro, whereas the positive experiences slide off like Teflon. I think it's really important when we are in good situations that are beneficial for us to reflect on that afterwards and return to those places, return to those people who bring out the wholesome qualities within us or the qualities that we want to see developed more within ourselves. Yeah, thank you for that. I ask Sunma to unmute, please. Are you able to unmute? There you go.
I'm pressing on my microphone.
Thank you.
I didn't have to press on unmute. You can call me Zopa.
Zopa.
It's fine.
Okay.
There were a few things that arose here. When you were first, you were talking about some conversation about, sounded like to me, I think it was with the fellow who went, I don't know if he's here anymore, but he talked about wisdom and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And you started to talk about something online. What I see is it's called scripted. And as far as that couple, to me, it's scripted. How can you keep following a script, meaning you're not thinking for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with children many years. And I never used those scripted things, animals you fill in. They made their own drawings, you know? And I think that quality is being submerged by the net, by FB especially. And like you said, you know, you have to be very choosy as to who you want to hang out with in regard to Dhamma.
Mm-hmm.
What I related to was all of it, of course, all the venerables, what they have these qualities developed. It's something to reflect on. But it was new to me to see that in the suttas, that really each venerable had different qualities developed. I'm sort of new to sutta anyway. But years ago, I learned about Vinaya, but I went the opposite direction. So I've come back to it after 15 years.
Wonderful.
Tibetan Buddhist practice.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to develop more. Reading the suttas, I wish I had more time. Mm-hmm. Once you start, you can't stop. That's the whole day already. That's half the day. Morning's gone.
Yeah.
There's a group, not group, there's a sanctuary, Sasana Raka in Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the teachers who was there for a while training, because he's going to open his own monastery in Mexico, he would teach also. And he gave a list of essential suttas. Very interesting how he created it. He interviewed all the monks, including the head monk, to see what the consensus of what they read most, what's most dear to them, et cetera. And then he made a list. I think it's very helpful because it's so much to look at, really. You get wrapped up. You can just say, yeah, you can just look at the list and like one a month or something like this.
Yeah.
So I like having the fact that there is a sutta teaching. There are others, but some of them aren't doing it anymore. Some of the other bhikkhu or bhikkhunis.
Mm.
And also I like the fact bhikkhunis are teaching sutta. So that's very refreshing. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe Ayasoma is not doing so much anymore.
Yeah,
she's kind of working on building a monastery, but that was one of the things that I was looking for a couple of years ago, is, you know, where are the bhikkhuni teachers? There's not many. So I think that's another reason why it's really important to continue doing these sort of groups. There's another thing I wanted to mention. There's a really beautiful sutta that's kind of similar to this one. I can't remember what it's called, but it's like some of the same bhikkhus are asking each other, so what kind of bhikkhu illuminates the sal tree grove? And then they can't really decide, and they go and they speak to the Buddha. But each of them, they list their own qualities. So you have Venerable Sariputta saying, you know, it's the wisdom. Venerable Moggallana saying it's psychic powers that illuminates the sal tree grove. It's Ananda is saying it's memory, very learned. So they each have their own qualities. And the reason why I loved that, was it Joseph who brought up the one that kind of sparked his interest? Because when I was listening to that sutta, it was while I was staying at a monastery and they were doing a reading. I kind of had the same experience as like as it was being recited. I was hearing... I felt, you know, my body did something. My body lit up, my mind lit up when I heard the qualities that encourage my practice. And of course, the Buddha's answer was even stronger. But it's nice. It's nice to kind of hear that we can have our strengths. And still and not necessary. It's not necessary to develop everything to perfection, even though an arahant is, I wouldn't say a perfected being, but you know, an awakened being is no longer judging anything, is no longer suffering, but and they have all of these qualities, perhaps, but maybe they don't. Like, there are a lot of enlightened monks in the suttas who do not have psychic powers. So yeah, it's kind of like we can just be ourselves, even when we do attain full awakening.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. So I will go to the chat. We have John. John says, the monastics that are walking within each group probably are at various stages on the path, so we'll have various levels of defilement still. For the most part, I think it doesn't say in this sutta, and I'm not sure where this is in the kind of chronology, but we do know that Ananda was not awakened until after the Buddha died, or rather after the Buddha attained Parinibbana. But the other bhikkhus, we know that Venerable Sariputta, he attained the first level of awakening. So he was Sotapanna after hearing the first teaching from not the Buddha, but I can't remember who it was, but another monk that he met, who was, I believe that monk who he met was at least Sotapanna as well, or may have been Arahant, I'm not sure. And I'm guessing that all of these bhikkhus, except for Ananda and Devadatta, because an Arahant would not have evil wishes, were already Arahants at this stage. But yeah, so there's a list of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis who are listed as the foremost in these qualities. So there is, I think Venerable Kema is the foremost in wisdom of the bhikkhunis. And I can't remember, but each of those foremost qualities that the bhikkhus have, there is an equivalent bhikkhuni who's kind of top of their field in that area. I hope that answers your question. So Boyana says, do you generally advise we keep those with unwholesome desires at bay? It isn't easy to ditch a family member. Yes, that can be very complicated. how do you advise to deal in a committed partnership where the partner has those unwholesome desires, but we generally care for them, genuinely care for them? Yeah, those kinds of relationships can be quite tricky. So if you're recognizing that a person in your life, say a family member or a partner, has like actual malicious speech or actions, what do you do? Yeah, I mean, you do your best to live by example, and we can only control what happens. Well, we can't really control our own minds, but we don't have the ability to control others. So if somebody in our lives is not acting in a way, is acting in a way that we don't approve of, or that is not in line with the teachings, we can speak with them gently and express how we feel when they're doing something like that. and even say, I don't know, maybe these actions are causing you to feel not so close to them anymore. So it can be a real kind of threat to the relationship that, you know, if they're doing things that are not good for you and not good for others, not beneficial, it can cause us to kind of turn away. So if we don't want that to happen, it's worthwhile to be open and honest, I think, with that person and express genuinely how we're feeling in response to their actions. Yeah, very, very difficult, these human lives and human relationships. Yeah, I hope that was helpful. And, you know, I'm not a counselor, so I don't know the ins and outs of all human relationships. But I think one of the most important things is our intentions. So if we come to a person with only good intentions, we want to benefit ourselves and we want to benefit this other person. We come to that situation with metta, with karuna, with love, with compassion, with only goodwill for ourselves and for others. That's all we can do. And we also discussed this afternoon how, and actually it's something that my friend used to say, is I am not responsible for the feelings of others. And likewise, others are not responsible for how I feel or how I react. So all we can do is go at a situation with the best intentions, and how the other person reacts is not our fault, and we cannot control how they feel or how they respond to what we have to say. Hope that was helpful. And it looks like we don't have any further comments or questions. We're coming close to the end of our session, but I did have another thing that came up for me when I was reading this was how to choose a teacher. And so, again, I think this takes some element of wisdom. But there's this list that my friend gave me a long time ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And I don't know where he got it from. And I was trying to find it, see if it was in the suttas somewhere. Or maybe, yeah, I'm not sure where it comes from. But I thought it was a really good list. So I'm not saying this comes from any authority, although it might. If anyone's interested, you can kind of search for it. What I put at the top of the list is that the teacher, whether it's a lay teacher or a monastic teacher, they have integrity. And if it's a monastic teacher, they follow the Vinaya well. And if it's a lay person, they have generally good sila. Their ethical behavior is at least following the 5 precepts. And we can never really know for sure, but we can, if we hang around with somebody for long enough, we can kind of see what they're doing and see how they're speaking with other people. And the next thing is that you feel like you can trust them, and the people who gravitate towards them are also trustworthy. So that's something that I've noticed here at Anukampa. Is I feel like I can genuinely trust Venerable Chanda and all the people who come here. They're all good people. All of you people who are joining online, you all have, I mean, I don't know you personally, but you all have very nice things to say. So I think that's a really good quality to look for in a teacher. Another thing is that you can feel at ease with them. So you're not feeling like you're guarded, or like you're kind of walking on eggshells around them. You feel like you can just relax and be at ease and just be yourself around them. And another thing that they teach from the suttas. So that's, I guess, more in the, I'm not too familiar with other traditions of Buddhism, but in what we kind of follow is early Buddhism. So we're looking at the Pali texts. And so we want to look for somebody who's not talking about their own experiences as if they are the words of the Buddha. So we come to maybe some retreat somewhere, and there's a teacher who's saying, you know, this experience that I had, it was an awakening experience. And we go to the suttas, and actually what they experienced was not in line with what it says in the suttas. So we can kind of just check in and test the integrity in that context as well. So yeah, this relates because you have all these bhikkhus that the sutta talks about who are known for their exceptional qualities. Who do we go towards? Do we go towards one of these bhikkhus who has these exceptional qualities, who teaches in line with the teachings of the Buddha? Or do we go to these other teachers like Devadatta, who maybe has other sorts of exceptional qualities, but it's not quite in line with the teachings of the Buddha? Offer that for your reflection. And it looks like we have another comment in the chat, so I will read that one. This is from Joseph. I think it's an unofficial title, but I've heard Venerable Sariputta also called foremost in gratitude. I haven't heard that. Do you have any tips to practice gratitude and keep in mind and maintain recollections of the good actions, words, and wholesome mental states you observe of others? That's very beautiful. And actually last year I was starting to practice a little bit more gratitude, and I'm going to be honest, it was hard. It's hard work. I don't know about you folks, but I incline more towards the aversion. So I can really easily pick up on negative qualities within myself and within others. But when it comes to noticing those positive aspects and things that I can feel grateful for, or, you know, that I maybe should feel grateful for, it was quite hard. And I was kind of complaining to my friend, and he's such a dear. He said to me, he recorded a voice message, and he said he compared gratitude to or my practice of gratitude, or you know, pick your difficult practice. And he said, it's a good thing that other people can't read your mind, right? Because then they would hear this internal struggle that you're going through. And he said, imagine you were learning some really difficult instrument. And his example was, I don't know, three xylophones at once. You're trying to play three xylophones at once. And he said, imagine if you're trying to play three xylophones at once and it was your first time trying it out, and you'd have the neighbors knocking on your door begging you to stop. So compare that to when we're starting a new meditation practice. It's a hard slog at the start. But if we're persistent and we keep in mind those qualities. Like, say, we want to feel some gratitude, we want to express gratitude for the meal that we're about to eat. And maybe we do a little reflection before we eat the meal. And maybe later on in the day, you want to do a little bit longer session. Maybe you want to sit down for 10 minutes and recall the lovely meal that either you cooked for yourself or that was offered to you. And you sit down and maybe you repeat words in your mind, similar to the way Bhante Sujato does metta practice. He just does something really simple. May I be happy? May I be happy? May I be happy? So it could be kind of a simple semi-mantra just to get you started. So I hope that was helpful. And I'm going to tell my friend that I was able to use his example in this session today. All right, we have one more comment and then I will hand it over to Minori. And so John says, how lucky are we to have crossed paths with Venerable Chanda and her Dharma friends? Sadhu times three. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah, I echo those sadhus. All right, thanks everyone for joining. Thank you for supporting me in my first Zoom session. And thanks to all, well, the two lovely people who are joining me physically in the room. And yeah, even though you're all kind of on screen, it's, it really helps to build community. So thank you all for coming so consistently to these online sessions as well.
And thank you very much, Anagarika Pachala. Today's, I didn't know it was the first teaching. It was wonderful, really, really good. And I'm sure many of us here are kind of very involved, and you can see the questions we received. And thank you very much. And also for all of us, today's program is offered on a donation basis, in the spirit of generosity, just like all the other programs that Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project and Venerable Chanda provides. With your generosity, Anukampa can provide these kind of teachings, valuable Dhamma talks, meditation retreats, and so many other events. And Anukampa exists solely from the community's kind generosity. And we as community attain good karma by enabling the teachings to happen. So how can you offer the Anukampa? There's like different ways, several ways to offer these ways of generosity. You can cultivate. So the main one is a one-time donation. You can go to Anukampa online in the website. You can do a bank transfer, PayPal, SumUp. There are three ways that we have put. SumUp is the latest one. But bank transfer is the preferred, because we don't get charged for that. And any amount is, not small. And all the small amounts, big amounts are gratefully received. Same way, it's a dana. It's a good practice for us who donate as well. A regular donation can be done if you are able. You can set up a standing order. And then also you can drop in online volunteer. You can email team@anukampaproject.org if you feel that you have something to offer, some special skills. And you can provide meals to the monastics, either in person or having make some cooked meal delivery. You can send groceries. There's a needed items list in the website. So there are so many ways. And Anukampa plans to have some volunteering events in the future. Keep looking from the newsletter. And the events are there in the newsletter as well. And so with your generosity, it's not only the teachings. You can see Anagara Gopachala there, and you can see there's so many other, several other, you know, aspired nuns, like, you know, getting attracted, as you say in the sutta, like, you know, getting attracted to the proper place. So that is you, the community, who are enabling those things. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Minori. And yeah, with your support, you can help to grow the community of bhikkhunis. And what a delight and what a treat to have more bhikkhunis in the world. So thank you, everyone, for joining. And thank you for continuing to support Anukampa.